So thanks very much. So welcome to the very last lecture. I mean, it's been a really great week, and I'll try to hopefully end on a pretty exciting note in that last time I talked about, you know, what we know about gravity, and then today, what are we gonna hopefully learn about it in the very near future? Because there's really, you know, a huge amount of work in this area. So I just said yesterday during the lecture, we summarized, you know, the three basic things you can test: the overall strength of the coupling, the length scale variation of that coupling, and whether that coupling is really the same for all masses, the equivalence principle. But what are the real frontiers, and what are the new techniques we're hoping to bring beyond the beautiful torsion balance experiments that have led the field for hundreds of years, essentially? So that's the theme today. So I made this kind of, you know, faux frontiers plot trying to show where all the new techniques are sitting at. So there's actually, I think, thinking about this, maybe four main areas that people are pushing to in tests of gravity. And we've heard about some of these already this week. So this is going to try to bring those together, some of the things we've heard, but then also put them in the context of what else is going on. So it's hard to draw a 4D plot, but here we have shorter distances. And I'll talk about some experiments trying to push to really short distances, micron scales and below, higher precision at, you know, all distance scales or in equivalence principle tests. And then we already heard from Marcus actually about this really exciting set of dimensions, smaller masses, and in particular smaller masses that we have in pure quantum states of their motion. And if we can make, you know, gravitational source masses out of quantum sorts of objects, this is going to be very exciting. So there's a number of different types of experiments. Many of them are moving in different of these four dimensions, so I've tried to schematically draw arrows where things are going, but the point is there's a lot of action in this field, and I think really, you know, technological breakthroughs hopefully that help us to, you know, break out of this box of gravity being so hard to test. So let me just go through each of these frontiers and tell you a bit about the experiments at these frontiers. So I'll start with the shorter distances. So if you ask, why can't we just do torsion balances better at shorter distance? That's a very reasonable thing to ask. I mean, this is this, again, beautiful result from Etwash just a year or two ago now. In this coupling versus length scale plane, so this is for a, you know, fifth force essentially with some strength alpha, where alpha one is gravity or gravity strength interaction. Yellow region's the excluded region, and again, we're able to measure, if you go along this line at alpha equals one, we're able to measure in Etwash gravity down to about 50 micron length scales. But then because of, if it's a Yukawa type force, because it's falling off exponentially in length scale, we really, there's this big open unexplored region even for forces as much as a million times the strength of gravity by the time we get down to one micron. So that's, you know, that's a pretty sharp fall off. But maybe a little bit more disturbing is that if you stare at these Etwash lines over the years, you know, there was a huge advance in technology in 2004 after some of these extra dimension proposals, large extra dimension proposals. With this first Etwash result, there's another big step here in 2007 with a better improved short distance pendulum. But then, you know, in literally a decade of really, really hard work to keep going with this, you know, the step between 2007 and 2019 here is somewhat smaller. So the derivative here, at least in the Etwash experiment, is in the distances they're able to go, is starting to fall off, and maybe dramatically. Now, if you ask why, it's because Etwash is not actually just limited by the sensitivity to measure small forces at short distance, but as you've heard throughout this week, we're really limited by backgrounds and electromagnetic backgrounds as we make things smaller and smaller. And, you know, a key feature of the Etwash technology, this is a cross-section from one of the PhD theses from Etwash. You can see their torsion balance. So this is the disk that makes up the torsion balance that they're actually measuring the position of. The attractor, which has the different mass varying patterns down here that, you know, is applying torques on that torsion balance. And then a super crucial detail is that between the attractor and the actual you know, measurement mass, there's this beryllium copper foil, gold-plated foil, that's hopefully screening all the electromagnetic interactions between these two so that only gravity can go through this ideally perfect Faraday cage. Now, in reality, the problem is that when we zoom in on the surface of the gold surface, let's say, of this foil, it doesn't look like a perfect equipotential. So we're always taught that conductors are equipotentials. Conductors are not equipotentials. And here's a very nice atomic force microscope image of a typical sputtered, very clean gold film, where you're seeing not only the electric potential on the surface here in millivolts, tens of millivolts, that's the color scale, but you're also seeing the surface topography. And if you stare at this, you might see there's some correlations between the topography of the surface, like actually physically the bumps on the surface, and the electric potentials. And just grain boundaries in metal films are enough to get you a slightly different chemical potential across those crystalline grains. And it's very, very hard to make real materials that have electric potentials smaller than tens of millivolts when you zoom in at micron scales. So when we zoom out from a metal, it looks like an equipotential because all of these random tiny little patch potentials, as we call them, cancel. But when you zoom in at the micron distances we're talking about here, even perfect gold conductors are no longer neutral. So that, yeah.
Is it because of the fabrication, or is it, I mean, can you do single atom depositions?
Yeah, so any real film has N reasons this can happen. One of them is these crystalline grains in, let's say, gold. You could imagine a perfect graphene sheet that should not have patch potentials, but then one speck of dust or one, you know, couple few molecules get stuck on it and you're back in the same story. But you could imagine putting a perfect graphene sheet in vacuum, argon ion cleaning off everything but the graphene. The ion quantum computing community is super interested in doing these sorts of things, and I would say it's technologically extremely challenging to get rid of these. And this, to date, this is the big problem in gravity searches to date, right? If you want to do them at short distances, stray charge on your best conductor you can make is the problem. It's not sensitivity, it's nothing else but this. So, you know, we'd like to do something about that. If you think of a way to make a better shield for Etwash and want to go out and build Etwash, you know, you could do things like cool this down, freeze it, put graphene. All those things are great ideas. I encourage you to go do them. Maybe you can beat Etwash and actually push this technology further. That said, I'll come back a little bit to a cryogenic torsion balance, but there's not a huge amount of effort, as far as I'm aware, trying to push, you know, push on this specific thing because it's very, very hard. So I would say a lot of the new ideas, we actually heard a really nice talk from Giorgio about some of the new ideas. But there may be to just completely change the paradigm and try to get some sort of masses where we can better control the electrostatics just in general. And now whether we can do that or not, I don't know, but you know, you could at least try some different techniques and see if any of these generic problems with non-neutral objects at short distance are any better. I'm focusing on this slide on using levitated optomechanical systems, exactly the thing Giorgio talked about, trap some micron-sized or even submicron-sized object. This was first proposed by Andy Jurasian and collaborators on this kind of really nice setup where you would have a standing wave optical trap, and you could have a sub-wavelength particle trapped in, you know, the essentially, you know, just near the surface at half a wavelength from the surface. You could coat this surface with gold. That would be your, you know, Faraday cage, the same sort of shield we just saw in Etwash, but very thin in principle, and then move a mass behind that. You would still have these patch potentials. But in principle, if those patch potentials don't move around and you do move this mass so that the density behind that is modulating, you could see a time-dependent force on that sphere from gravity and, you know, try to observe gravity. So that's very much what, like what Giorgio talked about. This is from the Stanford group's experiments doing similar things, although with larger spheres. So this would be like a femtogram mass. This is more like a picogram mass. And you can move, as Giorgio's group has now done, move these fingers of gold and silicon there. They've now put shields around it because you need this sort of shield at least to screen from patch potentials moving around or other things. And then our group at Yale has been also developing a completely kind of independent attractor where we have dense droplets of fluid moving in a microcapillary. So this is a 100 micron capillary then coated with gold. So the wall of that capillary actually serves as the Faraday cage, the thing that's not moving and shields everything that's happening inside. And then in our case, we have a dense salt solution, a polytungstate salt, which you can actually, geologists float rocks in this stuff, but you can make, you know, salad dressing, little tiny drops of salt water and oil, basically, and flow them through this capillary. Here's actually a picture with a nanogram mass floating a few microns from the surface of that capillary. Looking down on it before we coated it with gold, you can see these patterns of, if you really zoom in here, these are the dense fluid and then the lighter, less dense fluid. It reasonably periodic, you can see here, but we measure it in real time because we have two fibers here that just bounce light off, so we measure before and after it hits and just correlate. So it doesn't need to be perfectly periodic. But yeah, we can make these droplets. This is technology from biophysics or biology to just make little micron-sized droplets out of two different fluids and flow them through this capillary. So, So part of the reason there's like three completely different ideas here is the real challenge, just like in Etwash, is making an attractor that avoids this. Yeah, question.
In these liquids, this is maybe a really dumb question, but how is there an analog of these patch potentials or something like this? I mean, a liquid structure seems like it would be better because of surface tension, but maybe it's not as good a conductor.
Yeah, I mean, in any volume of stuff, there's still going to be charge impurities, stray charges around, and we're trying to shield any, you know, differences in the electrical properties of these different density fluids by having this gold. So, you know, in the real experiment, there's a completely hermetic layer of gold around that liquid. So now, instead of seeing the kind of charge disorder in the liquid stuff, which could be correlated with the density of the liquid, we should hopefully only see the patch potentials DC on the outer gold surface of the tube. In practice, I'll tell you, we see tiny, tiny pressure drops in the surface of that tube moving by some picometer or something like this, and that's enough to correlate with, you know, the droplets passing behind the tube wall. So nothing's perfect, but in principle, you can keep adding shield after shield, and, you know, there's no reason each shield doesn't give you some factor of, I don't know, 10 to the n, and maybe you can get rid of this stuff. But at least in these two attempts, which I think are the ones that are running, and I think Andy's also pretty close to this, we have been background limited just like Etwash and not yet reaching the intrinsic sensitivity of these devices.
Thank you.
But I guess the point of this slide is to show these are trying to solve the stray charge problem that Etwash also has in very different ways, maybe not yet succeeding, but maybe there's a technical path here with different systems. And then the other thing, like we saw this morning, very nicely, is actually the sensitivity is here, that if you could get rid of these backgrounds, you could see gravitational interactions between micron-sized spheres pretty easily in these traps. The problem is not that we couldn't see it, it's just that we measure forces a million times bigger than that from stray charge floating around. So I guess let me show you a little bit more about the spirit here in terms of how much control. You maybe have seen similar things from Giorgio, but I'll show you all the things that need to happen or things that you could imagine might help you control charge in these experiments. So the first thing is we trap the sphere and then we put in the trap, and crucially we can discharge the sphere, as Giorgio probably said. When we actually pull these spheres off glass in our experiment, they start with net charges, excess number of electrons as high as 10 to the 4 on this kind of nanogram scale mass, but then we just flash UV light, we put in an oscillating electric field, flash it with UV light, knock charges off. In this case, we even knock too many off, so we have like 60 more protons and electrons on this ball with 10 to the 15 protons and electrons in it, and then we knock electrons off a nearby surface and come back to zero, and then you see these very nice discrete steps corresponding to adding one electron at a time to the sphere. So this is crucial. We can get the net total charge of this object to zero. You just can't do this with any object other than a levitated object. If you have a string there, you are going to have currents flowing along that string, in fact. And we've now measured, you know, one of the reasons to you know, levitate an object is to get rid of thermal noise. We heard about that. That's beautiful. That gives you sensitivity to gravitational strength interactions. But another crucial thing about levitated objects is that the currents flowing on and off the object can be as low as one electron per week. So we actually see maybe less than an electron per week flowing on or off this. So once we get it neutral, we know it's neutral. There's no monopole charge changing on this object. Now, another thing we can do, so this is controlling the total net charge of the object. It's one of the largest objects we know for sure. We have exactly the same number of protons and electrons on. That said, any real charge distribution, if there's 10 to the 15 charges in it, as Giorgio said, can have a dipole moment or higher order multipole moments in the electric charge distribution. One thing we can do is then spin this sphere, and we can actually just use circularly polarized optical light, which can apply torques to this trapped object, and these things kind of naturally spin up to many megahertz rotational frequencies. So they're spinning a million times a second. If we go much faster, they actually blow up from centrifugal stress. Yeah.
Giorgio's talking about that we take advantage of?
Yeah, so
electric dipole moment.
So in Giorgio's experiment, they're spinning by applying a RF electric field to apply a torque to the electric dipole.
Yeah.
Here we're actually using optical torques to spin. And one of the advantages of that is you can spin it much faster. So you know, you don't have any limit to how fast you can make the kind of rotating electric field as Giorgio's experiment has. So this is very complementary. I mean, both work. I'll show in a second we're using both actually. But You can imagine if it's spinning this much, then you have a, you know, you average out the permanent dipole moment in any direction except the spin axis, and it's essentially gyroscopically stabilized. The faster you can go, the better, because the more you know that any torques on that object are not, you know, wiggling around your electric dipole moment. So once we've gotten rid of the total charge on the object, you know, the electric dipole moment's the leading order coupling to those patch potentials that we don't want, and so we need to control this dipole moment somehow. Giorgio talked about different ways of doing this, but just to show there's a huge amount of engineering freedom here, in principle, to control these backgrounds, even if in practice we haven't got there yet. So yeah, this is perfectly gyroscopically stabilized, spinning extremely fast. Our measurement frequencies are down, you know, at orders of magnitude lower frequency. If we want in our system, we can cool the center of mass of motion of this. So if we want this thing to be incredibly stable, we can actually stabilize the center of mass of the sphere to something like 10 picometers per root hertz. It's not crucial for these measurements, but it does, you know, sometimes it's practically useful. And the effective temperature here is something like 50 microkelvin. But then maybe even more crucially is once we have this dipole moment and it's spinning and pointing up, we could do the classical analog of a pi pulse in NMR. It's all kinds of tricks for, you know, handling dipoles, and we can do what Giorgio does essentially, but now here combining optical angular, you know, optically induced angular momentum with electrical torques, and we've actually shown we can flip the orientation over and take that charge distribution and make it spherical essentially over the measurement. So yeah, you know, you can flip and then do a differential measurement if it's spinning up and spinning down, or your dipole's pointing up and pointing down. So in principle, you can do all this. In practice, I'll show you where the field is, which is Giorgio's plot. So we haven't yet published these results, although have reached kind of similar sensitivity with this microfluidic tube. But the first, you know, published result is from Stanford, and you already heard about that. This is, again, a zoom in on that alpha versus length scale plot. Etwash is down here, torsion balances are down here, and, you know, after now five-ish plus years of work dedicated to exactly these experiments, we're here with the best levitated result from Giorgio's group. So that's a really huge accomplishment, but as you'll see, beating Etwash is a huge challenge, and that's a generically true statement. It's been true for the atom interferometers. I mean, the interferometer at Stanford has been working for a very long time to beat Etwash and is not quite there yet. These levitated systems are not there yet. But, you know, if we can get control of these backgrounds, I mean, it's quite easy to, you know, to reach sensitivities lower here. Whether we do that or not is very hard to predict because of the difficulty of how you control these backgrounds. So the hope here is we have more tools than we had in the past to try to do this. There's nothing fundamental that prevents us from doing it, but practically you can see where we are, and you know, it's maybe not where we hope to first lie on this plot in the first experiment. Many orders of magnitude to go. Now, that said, if you want to think really optimistically, we've heard some blue sky talks already this week on what might be possible with testing gravity with even possibly, you know, delocalized masses of this size. You can project, you know, with the kind of at the measurement limits, not even trying to squeeze or do any of the stuff that Marcus was talking about, you could project in principle being able to measure order unity strength gravity down to 10 microns, and if you could really get here, pushing further. So down to the micron scale, you might be able with these systems, if you could get rid of all backgrounds, to see gravitational strength interactions at much shorter distance. This is still far beyond the state of our backgrounds, though. Yeah.
So the red lines are Andy, and I guess the black lines are...
Yeah, this is something like Giorgio or Yale set up. Yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, at the essentially the standard quantum limit in a day or something like this. So that's the measurement sensitivity, and then the difference between here and here is the backgrounds, current backgrounds. Okay, so that's the story with levitated systems. Let me say that, you know, these are a good example of the classical kind of experiment you can imagine, which is you have a mass, you have a shield, and then you have another mass. I also talked about that last time. Even the torsion balances are mass, shield, mass. That's the kind of standard experiment you can do. And you can ask how far, like if we could just get rid of these backgrounds through magic, our perfect graphene layer with no impurities on the surface, how good could you do? And it turns out actually this experimental tool of mass and some mass behind it really only works down to micron distances. So we're actually, you know, if we could even go another factor of 10, we'd hit really fundamental problems beyond these non-fundamental but very tricky patch potentials. And one example is the Casimir force, or maybe the most fundamental example. You've already heard about the Casimir force. There's this standard picture of you have a vacuum, and then you put two perfectly conducting plates that changes the modes that can live inside, so you get this force just from vacuum. That's a standard story you hear, and it's been pointed out that maybe that's, even though you can calculate it correctly that way, maybe a more physical way that many of us think about it is that you can also derive the Casimir force just by thinking about the fluctuations of dipoles on the surfaces of those true objects. So you're not so much in that picture measuring anything about the vacuum, you're just putting some fluctuating dipoles near each other and they feel a force, which maybe you're not surprised about. That's an intrinsic thing that no matter what conducting material you put there as your Faraday shield, you're going to have that kind of force from fluctuating quantum fluctuations in the dipoles in that material. And so if you imagine, how thin can I make that Faraday shield until, any real metal, if I don't have any perfect conductor in nature, unfortunately, so any real metals can have finite conductivity at high frequencies especially, and this Casimir force is going to start leaking through here. And this is just a calculation relevant for the levitated microspheres, but for one of those 5-micron spheres, what you really care about is the differential force in the Casimir force that leaks through the shield between your low density and your high density material. So maybe if those are gold and silicon, which have somewhat different electrical conductivities, this is the Casimir force you get as a function of shield thickness. And you can see as you make that shield thinner and thinner, that's actually becoming big. And the gravitational force here for this relatively small sphere, again, is down here at 10 to the minus 22 newtons. And these Casimir forces, even the difference in Casimir force here, even in the gold copper case, which are more similar in terms of electrical conductivity, starts to shoot above gravity.
Yeah. Can I ask you, what are the reasons why it's better to use like a combination of materials, say gold and silica or copper, and not say just a plate of gold with empty lines? Is it
with empty holes?
Empty holes.
Yeah, so empty holes would be almost like the gold silicon in terms of conductivity, so it'd be even worse than this, because what sets the Casimir force is basically the difference in electrical conductivities of these materials. You want a big density contrast with identical electrical conductivity to cancel this force. Now, yeah, so that's an excellent question. You could imagine things better than gold copper, something like different isotopes of the same material, but now you're really killing your difference in density. But you might imagine things that could do better, but you're just not going to be able to kill this Casimir background at some point, yeah.
Could you explain why it's beneficial to use gold for one of them? Because I might imagine that if you just chose something that was lower in conductivity, it's easier to find something that's matched in conductivity.
So we like dense things like 20 grams per cc. Gold is one of them. And most of them are metals, so you want to kind of match that heavy, dense metal. But yeah, you could try to find things that have identical electrical conductivities and different metallic properties. I think the limiting case of doing something like that is different isotopes of a light species, but then you give a lot up in density contrast. We haven't reached these Casimir backgrounds yet, so we haven't really started pushing on it. I mean, we see more conventional E&M backgrounds, but assuming in the far future we get rid of conventional E&M backgrounds, this one really starts to bite down at nanometers and basically becomes impossible. And you could imagine, well, let's just measure the Casimir force and subtract it, but there's nothing, in real materials, there's no fundamental calculation. You need to know conductivities and ranges. You can't measure them, and you just can't subtract it at any high level of precision. People in the community argue about what they're measuring when they measure the Casimir force down here. Yeah. Another question?
Could you explain why the two explanation of the Casimir force with the dipole versus the vacuum fluctuation of a photon? Why are they equivalent? Do they give the same prediction, but like the physical picture seems quite different?
Yeah, they give exactly the same mathematics, so you get exactly the same answer, but the physical picture, like you say, is completely different. So I recommend you read this paper. So these slides are in Indico, and they are from last time too, so you can click on all the links. This is an excellent paper from Robert Jaffe at MIT from 10, 15 years ago, pointing this out, saying he doesn't, that people used to talk about measuring the Casimir force tells you something about vacuum energy. This is a really nice paper saying that In this other model, it tells you nothing about vacuum energy. So this is a debate that happened in the community like 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah. Thank you.
If you go to volume 4 of Landau and Lifshitz, there is like a whole derivation of the Casimir-Polder force between the two atoms, right, via the fluctuating dipoles, right? So it's just a specific question about that you can use other method with the conducting plates. But originally it was done with fluctuating dipoles.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, the words are maybe a philosophy of physics question more than a scientific question. There's been lots of arguments about philosophy of physics that you can find around this topic. Okay, great questions. Any others?
Yeah, could you just say, the version of the Casimir derivation I've seen is with this vacuum energy, so I'm trying to match the logic. In that picture, I don't see where the difference in conductivity pops up, whereas with fluctuating dipoles, I do see where the difference in conductivity pops up. So can you say a few words about...
Yeah, so in the perfect metal case, it's usually derived, you just have perfect conductors. The difference comes in the real world where you don't have perfect conductivity at all frequencies, and then you're taking some, you know, integral over some conductivity, distribution of conductivities that differs for different conductors. So that only comes now when we want to use different density materials as a mass we're putting nearby. Now those, because they have different electrical properties, not only do they have different mass, but they have different Casimir force. And it's exactly spatially correlated to the different gravitational force.
Thank you.
Okay, so yeah, this is a real problem to the standard idea. Like if you wanted, you know, Giorgio, who I think is really great for thinking about how you go to shorter distances, you know, is thinking about all kinds of ideas. And probably gold shields, you know, are not fundamentally practical at very short distances. So let me just show this really nice idea of what you could do. Now, there's practical challenges with this as well. But imagine instead of using a metal film to do this shielding of the various E&M effects, use the electron cloud around a nucleus. So we heard about neutrons being the perfectly ideal, you know, thing to test gravity with because, you know, they don't have a charge radius. Maybe we can't get enough neutrons, so currently neutrons aren't competitive. But maybe imagine using a nucleus and then just shielding out all the E&M effects because, you know, just like we heard about yesterday with thorium-229, you're just extremely well shielded from the environment where gravity can still affect most of the mass in your solid from the nucleus. And so there's this really nice idea about doing kind of absorption spectroscopy with, you know, nuclear energy. So in atomic physics all the time, you know, it's just expected that if you have some atom, it can emit a photon, and then another atom can reabsorb that photon with exactly the same energy. In nuclear physics, this doesn't happen, essentially because the photons have more energy, and the parent is recoiling, which changes the effective energy a little bit, so that when the, you know, the gamma ray or whatever is coming through, it can't be reabsorbed by another free nucleus, even if it's exactly the same type. So there's this kind of, you know, interesting atomic physics and the way we like to think about it stops working at standard kind of KeV or higher energies for nuclear physics. But there's this beautiful effect, the Mossbauer effect that was observed, where if you put those nuclei in a solid, then instead of getting a nuclear recoil of one nucleus in that solid, actually the momentum can be conserved by the entire solid recoiling together, and the energy transfer to such a massive entire solid is zero. So this is just another way of saying instead of making a phonon, you kind of make the zero, you know, the center of mass phonon mode recoils can recoil in a solid. This actually really happens so if you take the right isotopes, put them in solid films, you can then actually do absorption spectroscopy with KeV energy gammas. It's called the Mossbauer effect and Mossbauer spectroscopy. The other beautiful thing is because these nuclear transitions are so isolated from all the crap we have in the real world, by their electron cloud, these can have really tiny intrinsic lineless, relative lineless. You know, for most cases, maybe use these ones around 10 to the minus 12 or 10 to the minus 15, but there's in principle extremely narrow lines. So if you had some change in the potential felt by that nucleus, you might be able to see a tiny, tiny line shift. And so you can imagine what a gravitational experiment using the Mossbauer effect might look like. Giorgio and some collaborators wrote a paper on this, where you take some thin films, maybe put gold, a dense gravitational source, and then put iron 57, which is one of these good isotopes to use for mass spectrometry spectroscopy, and then bring this heavy, dense layer at nanometer separations from your iron 57, send in these photons, and then map out if there's any energy shift as you bring a mass nearby these iron 57 nuclei. And so, this avoids needing a kind of standard conducting layer shield. Here's what you can project the sensitivity to be. Again, these are the existing limits in the alpha versus lambda plane, and this is really now aiming to go below this micron length scale. These are the projections with kind of existing systems you might use for this. And you can see they're nowhere down near gravitational strength interactions. So this is a cute idea, but you're definitely not probing order unity gravity down here, but maybe you are able to kind of go below the best existing constraints on forces much stronger than gravity at these distances. And this is what you could do with maybe off-the-shelf sort of stuff, up to making these very flat sort of disks. We are living in an era where it's much easier to get extremely high-quality sources of KV photons, though, with synchrotron light sources, and if you could directly excite some of these extremely narrow transitions and avoid needing some hot radioactive source to do this, and really wanted to be ambitious, you might, nobody's drawing lines on this plot, but maybe this technique could go further. Okay, so this is just, I encourage everybody in this room to think beyond, Faraday cages and how you could do this at shorter distances. This is one recent idea, but think broadly, I think is the charge for young folks. Okay, any questions on this? Okay, so I think that's the last thing I wanted to say about the shorter distances. So I'll say just something really quickly about smaller masses. We actually heard from Marcus on this, so I won't say too much about it. But actually smaller masses and shorter distances are basically very interrelated because we have some upper limit on the practical density of materials. Again, gold, tungsten, things like this are 20 grams per cubic centimeter. So if we want to measure gravity between, at smaller and smaller distances, we can only pack so much mass there. And there's tricks to get around this like Edwash does. If you zoom in on the Edwash torsion pendulum, it's not just two balls pulling on each other, but the torsion pendulum actually consists of these 120 or something like 120 different fingers of tungsten and holes. So just the question we're asked. If you want the biggest mass contrast, just take away the tungsten on these fingers, and then as those fingers rotate around, each single finger can make a torque on the neighboring finger just across. And these have to be small. I mean, if you're trying to measure gravity at 50 microns, these can't be like infinite planes or else you kill your torque, right? So these need to be relatively small. So each of these fingers is actually relatively small in mass. So I think as Eric Adelberger would like to point out, gravity has been measured, by adding up lots of 100 milligram masses for many years in Edwash. Here's a zoom in of exactly what those look like. But we heard from Marcus why you might want to think beyond this. This is maybe, how you arrange the mass is in a classical experiment, just a signal to background question. How can you beat down these patch potentials while making your signal bigger and bigger? But if we want to do these really sort of quantum experiments that Marcus was talking about, where maybe the source of the gravitational field is in some sort of pure quantum state, you're probably not going to get away with doing this, right? So you need some sort of isolated mass. Marcus showed this picture, the state of the art with this torsion balance they've now demonstrated at Vienna. It's something like 100 milligrams, again, maybe one of these Etwash fingers in mass. But his near-term goal is to do, with a torsion balance, a single isolated Planck mass object. And the Planck mass in funny units is 20 micrograms, yeah.
Just to be 100% clear here, there's nothing special about the Planck mass, right?
Like
from this point of view, this is not remotely probing any kind of quantum gravity type effect. This is a very classical effect.
Yeah, this is a very classical thing. I mean, my opinion is definitely there's nothing special about the Planck mass. I don't want to misquote Marcus, but I'll say that if you're thinking of an interesting target to try to push smaller masses to, it's a number you can aim for, but yeah, I mean, on the theory side, what it means, yeah, it's just classical, right? I mean, it's just an interesting scale, numerologically, let's say. Yeah. But let me say, generically, my take on this whole field is that, we don't know a lot about gravity. Any new experiment we could plausibly do in the lab to measure gravity, if we can do it for, you know, the sort of tabletop scale costs, to me is interesting, just to show what we think is definitely going to work does indeed work. But you know, at the end of the day, we have to do what we can do. If we had a great experiment to do some real test of quantum gravity, we would be doing that. And this is kind of what we can do. And this is already extremely challenging. So, you know, it was a real tour de force, as Marcus was saying, to go to this mass, and now it's only 10,000 times lower to go to this mass. All right, so I won't say much about this because Marcus showed this. This is the torsion balance they built. Now they're trying to do this with 20 micrograms. But basically, they measure, you know, gravitational strength interactions, and their precision, again, the standard story here is kind of 1%, but they have 10% systematics from all the terrible things we've been talking about, which, you know, with these millimeter masses aren't quite as bad as when you get down to microns, but you still have patch potentials, vibrations, electromagnetic couplings, which likely account for the deviation here. Okay, so that's on the smaller masses side, and again, you know, if you want to say why do smaller masses, there's nothing special about them other than that maybe you, if you can think of any technology in which that mass, the source mass in your lab experiment is going to be in a pure quantum state, quote unquote, it maybe looks something like this. Okay, so let me keep going if there's no questions, and I'll talk about maybe the third frontier here, higher precision, not just in short distance and small scale. And actually, the next set of slides is all on atom interferometry, so we heard some really nice talks about atom interferometry earlier this week. These are focusing on now what can you do with atom interferometers to test the equivalence principle, inverse square law, the sorts of things we're talking about here, specifically gravity waves, all that other stuff is super interesting, but we've heard all the exciting stuff happening there. So, you know, it's been known for a long time that this seems like a really great idea to test the equivalence principle. Take your ultra-sensitive atom interferometer, take two otherwise identical atoms, but that differ in the number of neutrons, and then test if they fall the same. And because of the extreme sensitivity, you can get to these really tiny phase shifts. If there's a different gravitational potential felt by rubidium-85 and rubidium-87 here, you can in principle measure it. And so this is recent results from the Kasevich group. Just a year or two ago now, measuring this Edwash parameter to the 10 to the minus 12 level. Again, the actual torsion balance result is one or two orders of magnitude stronger than this, and this new microscope satellite in free fall around the Earth is even now in 10 to the minus 15 level. If you look at this, this is showing the difference in phase they measure for these two different species as a function of momentum transfer, but that's maybe a detail. You average this down, you get something like zero, but currently dominated still at the 10 to the minus 12 level by systematic errors. So this is a huge lift, an incredibly precise, amazing experiment to do this, but you know, not yet fundamentally limited, and limited kind of by how well you can prepare the interferometer. So this is really exciting. I mean, I guess you know the derivative, the Moore's law sort of curve you might draw through these points is a steeper slope than the torsion balances, but still a couple orders of magnitude from crossing it. So we'll have to see where it goes. And so this is work from the Kasevich group, but I should say the Tino group in Florence is also doing lots of tests along these lines.
Hey, David, yeah. Do you know, it looks like they're systematics limited. Do you know exactly what is happening? Is Jason in the audience?
Yeah, I mean, so.
There he is. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I can give you the one sentence. Yeah.
What is the kinem? You don't know. Ah, okay. Okay.
Yeah, so I mean, as far as I understand, I mean, these kinematic errors, which are dominating the budget here, are related to kind of the, you know, variances in the initial velocities and positions of the atoms when they launch them. I don't know exactly what, but vibrations, all the terrible stuff everybody deals with is probably relevant here at some level. Or, you know, imperfections in the beams and things that are doing the launching. But yeah, this is already a huge amount of work to get to this point, and still now with the microscope results, a few orders of magnitude higher systematics than needed to keep pushing down. Okay, so on the inverse square law side, so Tim Cavacci's group at Northwestern has been, as far as I understand, starting to build a new system to do tests of the inverse square law, not at extremely short distances, because the clouds of atoms are already kind of bigger. I'll give a counterexample to this in a second, but typically the clouds of atoms are kind of bigger than the scale of these kind of solid masses that you can do at short distance. You may not aim to do, you know, really short distance inverse square law tests, but maybe do extremely precise tests at longer distance. And so there's, you know, simple proposals where you just take your interferometer and put two lead blocks next to it. This is one way to measure the gravitational constant. The Tino group's done this, but then you can also, you know, do this as a function of distance and test the inverse square law. So these are just some plots I stole from Tim's slides, which show, you know, the existing current bounds here now. You know, this is millimeter scale here, so these are actually up at kind of, you know, tens of centimeter to meter scale with these giant lead blocks being placed next to the interferometer. And, you know, plausibly a goal for improvement of a couple orders of magnitude beyond the best existing torsion balance experiments. So these are measuring kind of fifth or ruling out fifth forces at the 0.1% level at these distances, and maybe you could get down to the 10 ppm level with these sorts of experiments. These are really hard, though, and you know, at this level of precision, you have to do things like maybe this won't be lead, it might be perfect crystals of silicon, so you don't know there's any holes in the masses and stuff like this. So controlling systematics is really hard in these experiments. So yeah, hopefully we'll see results on that soon. Just for completeness, I will show this, that there have been proposals with atom interferometry to do really short distance tests. This actually looks almost identical to that nanosphere experiment proposed by Andy Gerasian collaborators, where you have some different density masses moving behind a shield, here maybe matched in conductivities even a bit better. And then you have a standing wave trap with atom clouds next to it. I will say that our experience with the nanoparticles too is that you can draw, you know, impressive sensitivity curves. These almost look identical. It's actually about the same mass in a nanoparticle and these clouds of atoms. So your sensitivity projections might be very similar, but the real key is what kind of backgrounds you can reach. And these are relatively old ideas, and I'm not aware of a published short distance result from atom interferometers yet. So these are just projections, yeah. Okay, and then just to say, if you're going to do matter wave interferometry with atoms and you want to test a force that couples to mass, you might as well consider doing that kind of matter wave interferometry with a nanoparticle. This would be super exciting if we could do it. And so this is still a bit, you know, beyond the current state of the art in technology, but also from Andy Gerasian and collaborators, they considered what kind of sensitivity you could have, again, in the alpha versus lambda plane, if you did a nanoparticle interferometer. Here's actually, you know, maybe a near field interferometer, one of these Talbot interferometers, the same sort of thing that Marcus Arndt is using for macromolecules that Marcus Aspelmeyer talked about a little bit. But maybe just as you'd expect, if you kind of you know, close an interferometer with a nanoparticle next to a density varying source mass behind a gold shield, you can get sensitivity to, you know, some potential that comes from a non-Newtonian force. You can predict what sort of contrast you might have. This is for an acceleration here of 10 to the minus 7 times the Earth's little g here is Earth's acceleration. And the kind of projections you might get are, you know, pretty impressive looking projections for a few hundred nanometer scale particle. But again, this is a background free sensitivity projection. I tried to write everywhere that it's background free. And then the question is how many orders of magnitudes of backgrounds you do or do not have above that. You know, it's not obvious that this has any differences in backgrounds than just holding the particle there and doing classical sensing. But again, take a look at the paper if you're interested. This would be really impressive if we could do this sort of thing. Okay. Okay, so there's a couple more things. The precision section is really, there's lots of ideas. So let me just say the University of Washington group, so not at WASH, I think, technically, because Eric Adelberger, I don't think, is any longer involved in these experiments, but they're still developing improved torsion balances there for gravity tests at the University of Washington. Some of the other EdWash collaborators are working on this. And in particular, an obvious thing to do with the kind of torsion balances is to make them cold. They're currently sensitivity limited by thermal noise. Now, as I said, at short distances, they're background limited, not sensitivity limited. But if you wanted to do just better sensitivity measurements, you can get rid of the thermal noise. So just put the whole thing in a fridge. You know, this is easier said than done. We heard about pulse tubes today and other kind of helium-free cooling mechanisms. Those things vibrate like crazy. You can imagine if you're doing one of the, or you're making the best accelerometer in the world, which actually Edwash is doing, that some fridge slamming at the top of your cryostat's not a good thing. But they have shown they have this really beautiful kind of vibration isolation where they have a couple springs between their slamming around pulse tube up here and some magnetic damper, all this stuff, and have shown that they can measure, this is now a real system, this really exists. They've measured their amplitude spectral density of the smallest torques they can see as a function of frequency. At room temperature, they see this green curve that's kind of consistent with room temperature noise. And then they do see an improvement here in the blue sensitivity curve as they go to lower temperature. Ideally, at 5 Kelvin, they'd be down here at the yellow line. They're not quite there yet, but kind of what they expect with the temperature gradients they have in the system, they're starting to reach, yeah.
So since they're already putting things in the cryostat, I'm wondering, do you know if it's possible to use a superconducting niobium to evade the, you know, the potential problem that we had?
Yeah. So superconducting shields are a really good idea, and you might as well use them if you're cold. It turns out that there have been patch potentials limiting superconducting niobium metals before. So there's these famous experiments from the basement of Varian at Stanford in the 70s where they were looking for free quarks in superconducting niobium balls, essentially. And you know, they actually found free quarks. But those free quarks were patch potentials on the surface of the niobium coupling to stray electric fields. And maybe some creative data analysis, let's say. So, it's not clear the superconductor solves the patch potential problem because that comes from surface junk on the film. But if you had a perfect niobium film, then you could get, in principle, much better conductivity and maybe make its surface really clean. Yeah, good question. The other thing I should say is that in the ion trap community, it appears to be that you can freeze the patch potentials. This is especially true at higher frequencies. If you get the things that are actually causing the electrical potential variations on the surface cold enough, the high frequency part of them goes away. I think it's really not studied at all what the really low frequency patch potentials are doing when you get them cold, but maybe freezing the whole experiment actually also helps with the patch potentials. We don't know.
May I ask something? Does it also help with your Casimir differences?
Well, the superconductor might help with Casimir, but I'm not sure. I haven't done that calculation yet. It depends on the frequency dependence, and I'm not actually sure that the superconductor is extremely good, you know, with the highest frequency sort of things that the superconductor shields compared to a, you know, normal metal. It's a good question. Great. So any other questions? Very good questions. I'll try to keep going fast as I know we're reaching the end. But so let me just say on the precision, I mean, we've heard about this a couple times, so I won't say too much about it, but you can't beat space for having things truly in free fall without vibrations, all kinds of the accelerations we have in the lab. So there's this beautiful microscope mission, which just completed, and you'll find in last week's physics news some really nice write-up about it, as well as just published in PRL, the final results. Just to say a little bit more about this, so this is a platinum and titanium cylinder, and you're just letting them free fall around the Earth. You have some satellite around that to block everything out so that nothing can touch these. These are almost like, you know, LISA-style masses that are protected from the rest of the universe and just only feel the gravitational potential and fall around the Earth. And then you're looking to see if the platinum or titanium fall differently. They have different kind of fractions of neutrons in them. So this is a really precise equivalence principle test at distances kind of, you know, just a bit larger than the Earth radius. They have all kinds of systematics they worry about. So the satellite's turning around all the time. In the frame of the satellite, the signal's going and, you know, modulating around in different directions. So they can really control systematics extremely well. Data was between 2016 and 2018 with the final results just published. And this is what reaches this kind of 10 to the minus 15 level sensitivity to this Edwash parameter. So again, this is, you know, an order of magnitude or more than that better than the best torsion balance and a couple better than the atom interferometry measurements we were talking about. So they, you know, Again, we're kind of systematics rather than sensitivity limited really here. Their systematics are not drastically smaller than their statistical sensitivity. So if you want to improve this experiment, you have to really push down these systematics. The claim is that now that they've understood the systematics, which are mostly due to thermal effects in this experiment, this sort of thing in principle probably could get in a next generation to the 10 to the minus 17 scale, which would be pretty impressive. But it may be for long-range equivalence principle tests that space has now surpassed anything we can do in the lab. All right, so let me just finish with a couple words about quantum tests. I'm not going to say much about this because Mark has talked about it so much, so I'll try to talk about different things. I'll just put the link here. Marcus said you should read this really nice write-up from this 1957 Chapel Hill conference. Click on the link here and read it. It's really fun to read. There's basically two experiments possible. So the one Marcus was mostly talking about was taking two spheres, delocalize them, so expand the ground state wave packet in position to be really, really large. And then at some, if you have some extremely tiny coupling from gravity and you can get rid of all the couplings that are so much bigger than that, so that they're only interacting gravitationally, then you can imagine they become entangled if you could expand the wave packet by factors that are like 7 or 8 orders of magnitude bigger than the current state of the art. So that's really super exciting if you could do it. The other experiment, which essentially has equivalent sensitivity, and it's technically which is easier, is to put those masses, two masses in a superposition. Now instead of the wave packet being big, you've spatially separated them. As Marcus really nicely showed, the same figure of merit applies to both, so it's just which you can do better. I guess the thing I'd point out, I'm not sure that Marcus showed this plot, is just really how hard this is. I was talking about for the short distance tests, all the sort of stray ENM effects that show up. So those are kind of shown here. This is the coupling rate versus particle separation for this case of the wave packet separation that Marcus was talking about. If you had even one electric charge on these, that would be 18 orders of magnitude bigger than gravity, something like this. Now, I just showed you we can control the charge on with single electron precision, so that's not really a problem. But if you calculate the dipole-dipole coupling of these things with the measured dipole moments in Georgios or our group, that's like 7, 8 orders of magnitude bigger than the gravity interaction. So you need to shield or improve those dipole interactions by 8 orders of magnitude. You need to get rid of the Casimir force either by going far away, which kills your coupling a little bit, or shielding this Casimir force sufficiently. And then maybe you can get to gravity and get rid of all the other decoherence. So I won't say much more about this other than to go back and, we all heard the talks by Marcus, which are really, really extremely exciting. But I'll just say that many of the experimental challenges you need to make this idea work are similar to the short distance test. So if we get to the point that we can do these kinds of experiments, we've probably blown away those inverse square law plots at that point, or maybe even discovered something down there. But beyond the challenges you have in dealing with patch potentials, shields, all the other things, you also have to create these delocalized states, get rid of decoherence, and I think a real challenge is that even if we can shield these things with a shield, we have to keep that shield from decohering the particles. And you can't shield the shield at some point. So we really, I think, need to think carefully about how we might be able to implement this or other ideas that can do similar things. But yeah, if we can do this, this is super exciting both for making a source mass for gravity in a pure quantum state, but also for solving the technical problems that have bedeviled this field for so long. So 19 years and we'll be reporting results. Okay, let me say that beyond what Marcus talked about, maybe there's an intermediate step that I'll just show, and we actually heard a little bit about this week. So in the ideal experiment, you have a quantum source mass in a quantum state that's attracting another mass, and then you're verifying entanglement between the two through only their gravitational interaction. But you could imagine having a quantum system gravitationally interacting with a classical system and see if you can see interesting quantum effects there. And one of those experiments, which is extremely beautiful, is to drop these ultra-cold neutrons in the Earth's gravitational field, watch them bounce, get these revivals, quantum revivals, all kinds of truly quantum phenomena for the neutron. And there were some statements made about, this testing, certain aspects of, the sorts of things that Marcus was also talking about. There's actually another extremely similar proposal that just showed up in Pyrex Quantum to say, take an atom interferometer And then, you know, have it gravitationally interact with a classical pendulum. And then, you know, see if you can see entanglement between the atom system and this classical low frequency oscillating oscillator. And then maybe all you have to, you don't have to measure the quantum state or control the quantum state of this oscillator and just measure the atom population. And then you might see these revivals, quantum revivals, very similar to the revivals we saw in those beautiful movies of the UCN. So this is an idea. I will say, though, that it's been pointed out in a series of papers right after this that analyze this case specifically, that you can get these same revival phenomena semi-classically. And unless you are able, at least, you know, there's some discussion, substantial discussion of this, so you should read these papers if you're really interested. But I think the bottom line, at least in my understanding, is that if you really wanted to verify entanglement with no loopholes in this kind of experiment, you can't do that unless you understand the quantum state of the mass. And so this is unfortunately, I think, saying that in order to really do a loophole-free test of these sorts of quantum entanglement with gravity only, you do really need something like Marcus was talking about. And at least to date, we haven't figured out something more achievable in the near term. But that said, this is a super interesting experiment to do, and I believe maybe Holger Müller is going to do it in hopefully the relatively near future, because this doesn't really require new technology to do. Okay, so let me stop there. If you take away one thing from these two lectures, is that we can't really measure the interesting things we want to about gravity because it's so weak. That makes these experiments extremely challenging, but there really is a huge amount of activity and new ideas in this field, and I think we are going to push on all of these experimental frontiers in the coming years. So yeah, stay tuned or come help. Yeah.
Questions? So thanks very much. In the spirit of being open-minded, so you went over shorter distances, higher precision, smaller masses. There is one particular direction where many people are passionate about, smaller acceleration, right?
Yeah.
Because because of the M word, mode,
yeah.
Right? So do you think it's kind of feasible to get a satellite mission that will be sort of measuring possible corrections to absolute acceleration to greater and greater precision? I know that in this sort of inert science, in the strong field, there are some additional suppression to the corrections, but probably if one could think carefully, one could design such a mission similar to microscope.
Yeah, so I am not a Mond expert, so I can't really answer this question. There's all these funny effects that happen. Like you say, if there's other masses from the solar system around, there is a paper from Peter Graham, Giorgio, some other folks about sending a satellite out of the disk, you know, of the solar system and doing gravity tests with it. I don't think they talk about Mond in that paper because maybe, you know, depending on your interpretation of Mond, you're still in too high of an absolute acceleration from the Milky Way. But I don't know.
Can I ask another question about the patch charges? So is it possible to, after you have something deposited and you go and measure patch charges, can you attempt to try to fix them? Like, I don't know, bombard with some electron and see if you can move potential around or something like this. Is it just that the scales on which you'd have to machine are so small that this is impossible, or?
No, yeah, so this is an excellent question. It's very possible in principle. It's hard to do in practice, and there's now billions of dollars, I'd say, flowing into ion-based quantum computers, and maybe they're just going to solve this sort of thing. But, you know, these ion chips where you're trying to levitate ions next to a gold surface, and you have a charged object, so patch potentials really hurt you. They've done all kinds of things. They've tried to put down perfect gold films, argon ion clean them in vacuum, do all this stuff. You can come up with N ideas because it's not a fundamental problem. You can do this, but nobody, I think, has been extremely successful in either the ion-based quantum computing community or in the, you know, it's a different regime at very low frequencies, but in the sort of frequency range that applies to these experiments. They, for better or worse, practically, we have not solved this problem, but there's no fundamental reason not.
And if this overnight were solved, you would get those plots that you showed, right?
Yeah.
That just are two
or. You know, something else might show up. I don't want to say something else isn't going to show up, but yeah, you would move down. Yeah.
Let's thank David again. Let's, I guess, thank all the lecturers. David is still here. Jason still here. Mina still here.
And then let's thank you guys, because you guys make this happen. Thank you so much for all your questions over the week. And we would really appreciate, as I said in the beginning, this was a bit of an experiment. So we would be grateful for your input, what you liked, what you didn't like, if we're going to do this again in the future. So, and I know one complaint. That would be that we were going too long. So anyway, thank you so much. Thank you.